Trying to get Circuit Judge Barron, presiding judge in Cruz and Curry County on the line. We'll move forward in just a second.
Okay. Good morning. This is Rick Barron.
Good morning, Judge. This is Representative Krieger.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And I've introduced you to the committee and that who you are. And we're going to start out with Senator Burdick to talk to us because she has just a few minutes. She has to get to another meeting. So, Senator, if you could go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jenny Burdick. For the record, I represent the people of Senate District 18 in Southwest Portland, Tigard, and King City. I very much appreciate the chance today to testify on Senate Bill 528 that came out of the Senate Judiciary on a unanimous vote and passed handily in the Senate. The Senate Bill 528 contains the so-called Blakely fix, and this refers to a Supreme Court decision issued last June that basically threw a bomb into the Oregon sentence guideline system. This Supreme Court decision, known as the Blakely versus State of Washington decision, said that if criminal defendants are going to receive enhanced sentences under sentencing guidelines, that the enhancements, the aggravating factors, have to be that the defendant has the right to have those aggravating factors proved beyond a reasonable doubt before a jury. And of course, the defendant, as they can under criminal process in general, can waive the jury or can still make pleas. But they have to have an opportunity to have these factors decided by a jury of their peers beyond a reasonable doubt. Oregon's sentencing guidelines system is a very good system for ensuring equal justice around the state. And basically, it's a grid. I have a copy of it with me that includes crime seriousness, criminal history, and it has a grid of what the range of sentencing should be. The Blakely decision applies to the so-called upward departures, where the grid says you can have a maximum of 60 months in prison because an aggravating factor exists. And some of these are pretty serious offenses in their own right. Some of them, aggravating factors related to the offense include torture or deliberate cruelty, vulnerable victim, use of a weapon. And some aggravating factors related to the defendant include racial bias or someone on supervision at the time of their offense. So by making this requirement that these findings be made with the jury of their peers, Blakely did two things. It basically gave us a mandate that if we wanted to preserve our sentencing guidelines, we'd have to come up with some system to comply with the constitutional requirements that Blakely requires. And secondly, Blakely was almost immediately determined to apply to cases, criminal cases that are still somewhere in the pipeline in Oregon. In other words, maybe there was a finding, a circuit court finding, but maybe those cases were on appeal. It was widely interpreted, I think that was a correct interpretation, that the Blakely requirements apply to those cases on appeal. So what you're seeing now is remands from the Court of Appeal back to the circuit court to comply with the Blakely findings. So within days of the Supreme Court decision, the governor set up a work group that consisted of all the parties in the criminal justice system, the Judicial Department, the Attorney General, the Department of Corrections, the Criminal Justice Commission, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Office of Public Defense Services, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And as co-chair of the Interim Judiciary Committee, I was also a member of that group, and I know you, Mr. Chair, kept in very close touch with the work of the group. And I might also mention that Judge Barron, who's on the phone there, was a very hardworking and helpful member of this work group. So I'm very pleased he's on the phone today. So basically, what the Blakely fix does is it's based on a model set by the state of Kansas. And before the Blakely decision came out in the U.S. Supreme Court, there was a state decision in Kansas called the Gould decision that was very similar to the Blakely decision, but it occurred on a state level. So they had had about a 3 or 4 year jump on us in terms of how to deal with this. What Kansas did was they threw all the sentence enhancements, the aggravating factors, into a separate jury proceeding after the trial. And the work group discussed that as a possible option, and instead of adopting a straight, what we call a Kansas model, the work group came up with a proposal to have a modified version of that, where aggravating factors that are related to the offense itself can be tried right along with the offense in the criminal proceeding itself. And there are notice, it either has to be included in the indictment or the charging mechanism, or it has to, or the prosecutors have to provide adequate notice that an aggravating factor is going to be tried. And so that's a unique aspect of ours. By doing that, if something is to be tried in the guilt or innocent phase of the trial, there's a provision for not having it in that phase of the trial if the information itself would be unduly prejudicial. So the judge can make the judgment on whether that can be tried in the guilt-innocence phase or needs to go to a separate jury proceeding after the trial. So let me just run over the key components of Senate Bill 528 that you see before you today. Prosecutors must notify a defendant of the applicable sentencing enhancement factors prior to trial and may do so by pleading them in the accusatory instrument, which is the indictment in most cases, or providing written notice of them within a reasonable time after filing the accusatory instrument. Secondly, the offense-related enhancement facts are tried at the same time as the guilt-innocence phase of the trial, when the jury determines whether the defendant committed the charged crime. The enhancement facts that are related to the offender are tried in the sentencing phase that is conducted only if the defendant is found guilty of a crime. If consideration of an offense-related enhancement fact would fairly prejudice the jury deliberations on the defendant's guilt or on the underlying offense, the court has the authority to defer consideration of that enhancement fact to the sentencing phase of the trial. The intent here is that the trial courts would err on the side of deferring an offense-related fact to the sentencing phase if there is a chance that the fact might unfairly affect the jury's decision as to the underlying guilt of the defendant on the charge or charges. A defendant may choose to have a jury trial solely on the traditional elements of the offense and either admit the enhancement facts or have the judge determine whether the enhancement facts exist. Again, as long as the defendant has the right to a trial by jury on the enhancement facts that comply with Blakely, even if the defendant in one way or another waives those rights. And I think it's important to note, Mr. Chair, that Senate Bill 528 does not create new crimes or alter existing punishment ranges. Rather, it provides a constitutionally permissible mechanism for the determination of additional material facts when the existence of those material facts authorizes the sentencing court to impose an appropriately enhanced punishment for commission of the underlying core crime or crimes. Now, we actually had, after we had a hearing on Blakely, before the work session, I actually had a separate hearing on whether Blakely should, the provisions of Senate Bill 528 should be made retroactive, and if so, how retroactive. And traditional thought in the legal community, as I said before, is that Blakely, the Blakely requirements apply to cases that are currently in the system. So we decide, and Judge Barron was an active participant in this, it's always, you always have to know what you're doing when you make any statute retroactive in this process. It always raises issue. Judge Barron and my judge in Multnomah County, Judge Marcus, were very, very helpful in helping us sort through the issues around that. So what we ended up doing is we made likely retroactive for cases that are currently in the system, and that the judges told us that if we didn't do that, that they would have to kind of make up their own process for dealing with these remands, and it could amount to a get-out-of-jail-free card for some offenders who are probably our most serious offenders, some of these remand cases. So I feel very comfortable of having limited retroactivity in Senate Bill 528. It's been quite a process getting to the point where we are, and again, the work group just did amazing work, and since Judge Barron's on the phone, Judge, I wanted to thank you personally for your participation in this and your constructive contributions, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, I want to make sure we understand we are in a public hearing portion of that. Anyone have any questions of the Senator? She's worked really hard on this and probably knows a lot more about it than most people in the building. Representative Ackerman?
Good morning, Senator. I just have a few questions for clarification. In the event enhancement facts are alleged in the indictment, do you anticipate that that would require the district attorney to allege the precise sentencing guidelines which they would apply that would provide for upward enhancement? Is that really what we're talking about here?
I don't believe so. I think the sentencing guidelines, and I'll get help from counsel here, but the sentencing guidelines would go around the crime itself and the enhancing. So if you charged a particular crime, you'd know exactly where the sentencing guidelines were. So if counsel wanted to add anything, I'd be.
I have a question of counsel with my question then. I direct my question to
Chair,
counsel.
Chair Krieger, Representative Ackerman, I think the answer to your question, if you're referring to the what is under the sentencing guidelines known as the aggravating factor, which is the justification for going beyond the presumptive sentencing guideline range, if under current law the court makes that determination. Under this measure, under Senate Bill 528, while the jury would make that recommendation, the factor itself, I think whatever it is or set of factors, would have to be alleged in the charging instrument or provided through notice by other means, through letters is the alternate way that the bill designs notice to be provided. And while the measure itself does not specifically define what those enhancement facts are, I think that the although my participation in the work group was late in the game, I think that understanding of the parties was that the aggravating factors that are noted under the sentencing guidelines are the ones that everyone is talking about. That's not without some risk, however, because some of those aggravating factors, you know, it was pointed out in the work group, are might be a little bit vague and might be difficult for purposes of proof. And I think that Senator Burdick in her testimony made reference to some of them that I think everybody agrees to that are the with respect to the defendant-related enhancement facts motivated by racial or sexual bias on supervision at the time of the offense, offense-related aggravating facts such as torture, deliberate cruelty, vulnerable to victim, use of a weapon. I think the belief is that that must be pled in the charging instrument or otherwise given notice by the state.
Okay. I just want to make sure, since enhancement fact, I think I know what it means, but I don't know if the rest of the lay community knows. The way I would see this happening is that the specific guideline which would provide for enhancement of the sentence would be either alleged in the indictment or would be provided by the alternative notice proceeding. I think anything short of that is would be a failure of due process.
And that is in the bill, Representative Ackerman. It has to be by one of those methods, either in the indictment or by adequate notice.
Right. I'm just trying to say what is an enhancement fact to make sure we understand what that could be. Senator, I have another question, Mr. Chairman. It appears that we start from the premise that the the guilt phase, the innocence or guilt of the defendant would be tried along with the enhancement facts unless the defendant would opt out of that under Section 3, Sub 4. Did you consider that enhancement facts should not be tried before a judge or jury? In other words, this gives you have an option here, and I don't realize the defendant can opt out if there's an unfair prejudice, but could you consider just making it a two-part proceeding without that opt-out proceeding?
Yes, that is how they do it in Kansas, and that was discussed, and the work group decided to take this kind of combined approach instead.
And one last question. Was that the position of the American Civil Liberties Union or the defense counsel, criminal defense people?
Maybe Judge Barron could help me out here. I don't recall where all the parties were on some. They sometimes crossed over. I think the important protection in the trying the enhancement facts in the proceeding is there is a provision if those the enhancement facts themselves are very prejudicial to bump them out to a separate proceeding and give the defendant the ability to just have a judge decide them.
Okay, Judge Barron, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, if I understood the question correctly, it was whether or not we considered having the enhancement facts tried during the sentencing phase only?
Correct.
That's right.
Okay. I think the defense bar at one point would have preferred having the Kansas model where everything was tried during the sentencing phase, but I think during the work sessions that generally there was a consensus that the approach we have was an approach everybody could live with. And one of the reasons, frankly, is because if they relate to the offense, those matters are going to be coming up during the trial of the basic elements of the case anyway. They would be coming up, so the evidence would be coming in anyway. And I think everybody generally agreed that this approach was a viable to that question.
Okay, Representative Ackerman, do you have any further concerns?
No further questions.
You do?
No further questions.
Okay.
None.
I have a question, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to focus Senator Burdick on the sunset in January 2008. I think this looks like a great piece of work that brought this legislation together, and I realize it was a long piece of work. This is a decision that came down about a year ago, and I'm just wondering if, in order to make any to extend this bill, or if it's enacted, or to make changes in it, would have to be done in the next legislative session, the 07 session, because it's going to sunset in early 08. And I'm just wondering whether we'll have sufficient experience under these rules in the next year and a half before that next legislative session convenes, or whether it should be a longer period of time to see how the case law develops and how the experience under these rules develops.
Well, that's an excellent question. I think we're going to see some case law that comes in the very short term, and then probably more case law in the longer term. A good example is consecutive sentences. We heard the argument in the Court of Appeals. They invited us over to hear that, and I actually went and listened to the oral arguments on that. The thought is that it could very well be that consecutive sentences will be defined by the Court of Appeals to be an enhancement. Now, we structured Blakely so that if consecutive sentences are determined to be an upward departure, that the bill is broad enough to include those. So that's just one example. We just felt that this is a brand new area of law, and we felt that by extending the sunset just for the next into the next session, that it would give us an opportunity to make the judgment there whether there were some tweaks necessary or whether we could just go ahead and extend the sunset again and wait for more case law to come. There are a couple cases working their way through. One is whether juvenile adjudications are covered by Blakely. There's a case pending in the Supreme Court, and that will be an area of law that we'll have to pay attention to. Consecutive sentences, whether restitution can be defined as a sentence, upward departure. So all these things are kind of percolating their way through, and we just felt that we wanted to have at least the option. And it could just be a rubber stamp. We need to wait another couple years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee? Anything else, Senator?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just delighted you're taking this up. This has been a very good process. And
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judge Barron, would you like to testify, or did you want to listen as the others who are going to testify come through and close at the end, or what would you like to do?
Whatever the chair prefers me to do is what I would like to do.
What?
I'm happy to say something now and then remain on the phone for questions, if that's appropriate, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you do that? Go ahead and identify yourself again for the record, and then we'll go ahead and have your testimony, and you can stand by and listen to the rest of it.
Mr. Chair and other members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Rick Barron, and I'm presiding judge of the 15th Judicial District, which is Coos and Curry counties. I've been on the bench for a little over 25 years and been presiding judge for about 24 years. Senator Verdi made a good review of what this bill does and talked about the membership of the work group. We also had assistance and input from Bill Taylor and Joe O'Leary, which we very much appreciated. I think that one of the things that the committee should be aware of is the amount of work that was put in by what I consider, and I'll exclude myself from this compliment, very good professionals who work on a daily basis on these issues. The work group was very respectful of each other's ideas. We worked very hard to reach a consensus on this, and I think everybody can be proud of the people that represent Oregon in different capacities, both from the defense bar and from the prosecution side. The idea is when we started this group went from doing nothing to adopting the Kansas plan to anything in between. And I think two things kind of drove the process that eventually reached the product. And one of the first things was both Senator Burdick and Representative Krieger met with our work group early on, and both indicated that they thought this was an important area to work on. They both felt that the work group, I think, had the qualifications and the expertise to work on this, and they made it clear that they thought the work group should come up with a product and give it to them as a starting point for legislation. That was a clear direction from the people who have to make policy, and that was a very forceful direction that they gave us. The second thing that happened was that during the work group, we had a discussion about a lot of issues, and there wasn't consensus or agreement on a lot of the issues, and that discussion went on for a while. And then I think the work group got to the point where we began to talk about those issues on which we all generally agreed had to be in a bill to meet the Blakely problem. And once we focused on those aspects with which we all agreed had to be in place at some point, we began to work on ideas that we could all generally agree on that were broad enough to cover the issues, and that led to the product that the work group had. I mean, and it has remained a work in progress up to and including the time that the Senate Judiciary Committee was holding hearings and voted on the bill, and then when it was passed out of the Senate. And throughout this time, the work group was included in any discussion, and there were many issues that came up after the initial draft of the bill, and there were many emails and phone calls that went back and forth. And again, I think on nearly everything, a consensus was reached that people could live with. I was happy to be part of this group because of what they did, and I think the product is a really, really very good viable option to meet the Blakely issues. There will be issues that come up, and there will be issues that may be resolved after this legislation is passed. But in the meantime, we will have a way of dealing with this very difficult problem. And as I said, I think this is a viable option that the committee should, and committee is giving very serious consideration. And that'll just end my remarks. I don't think I need to go into the structure of the bill. Senator Burdick did, and other people will probably testify to that. I'll just remain on the phone, but I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Barron. Committee members, do you have any questions of the judge? Looks like they're going to let you off or leave you, Judge Barron.
Okay.
Okay, and you can stand by if you like, and we have some other folks that are going to come up.
I will do that. Thank you.
Jonathan Fusner, please.
Good morning, Chair Krieger and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Fusner. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. And on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers, I'm here to urge your support for Senate Bill 528. I was the Attorney General's representative on the work group that you've heard about, and so I'm pretty well acquainted with the considerable amount of highly professional and really kind of heartwarming work that went into this bill by defense attorneys, prosecutors, those of us who handle criminal cases for the state on appeal, Mr. Gartland from the Public Defender's Office, judges, and many others who worked very hard to get this bill put together. In the process of doing that, we realized that there are many unknowns to how the Blakely decision is going to play out. It's going to take years of litigation on appeal before we have the final answers to many of these questions. I would like to touch on simply one of them and echo what Senator Burdick said about it, and that is the fact that we don't know precisely what Blakely will end up applying to. Let's take consecutive sentence determinations, for example. Those require findings of fact in many cases before a consecutive sentence can be imposed. And we simply don't know, and we're not going to know for quite a while, whether Blakely applies to consecutive sentences. And that's why I believe that the members of the committee were in agreement that we wanted to use a term for what it is that we are submitting to the jury. We picked a definition of enhancement factor. We called it an enhancement factor rather than a departure factor, because it may be that factors other than the ones that are simply limited to upward sentence departures, but other factors like consecutive sentence findings, may end up being submitted to a jury. And the definition of an enhancement factor that's found in the bill is a fact that is constitutionally required to be found by a jury. And I think you can see that there's a lot of breadth, at least in my view, and I think I speak for the members of the governor's work group on this. There's a lot of breadth to that term, and I think that the legislative record should be clear on this, that the intent of the group was to make that term as elastic as possible so that a number of different kinds of factors could be submitted depending on both what the appellate courts tell us is required and also on whether you may have parties who want to do the careful, cautious thing and they want to submit a factor to the jury that maybe there isn't a case that requires that factor yet to be submitted. But if both parties say to the judge in the trial, we think we want to submit this to a jury so as to make sure that this conviction or this enhancement or this consecutive sentence isn't later reversed on appeal. It's my understanding that the intent of this legislation would be to allow the parties to do that. And with that, just focusing on the meaning of that term, enhancement factor, that's all I had this morning to say to the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Committee members, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kelly Skye, please.
Good morning, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative liaison or legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we were involved in the Blakely work group that resulted in this bill. We are neutral on the bill and, in fact, support most of the bill. I am here simply to talk about retroactivity, which was added into the bill by amendment at the last hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Our members are very concerned about the retroactivity provisions in this bill because there is a strong belief that that applying these enhanced sentences to certain cases that were already in the pipeline will violate the ex post facto provisions of both the federal constitution and the Oregon constitution. There are actually two sets of cases that we're talking about. There are the cases, when I talk about the cases, I'm referring specifically to the incident date, the date that the crime occurred. And the cases that where the crime occurred prior to the Blakely decision, those cases may not be, don't have as strong of an ex post facto violation argument. However, for the cases that have, where the incident date occurred since the Blakely decision, we believe that that applying this retroactively will be a clear violation of the ex post facto clause of the United States Constitution. In fact, just this past weekend, I was at a legal conference where I heard Jeff Fisher speak, and he is the attorney who successfully litigated the Blakely case in the U.S. Supreme Court, and he spoke to this issue specifically, stating that he believes for those cases with incident dates occurring after the Blakely decision that any subsequent Blakely fix or Blakely legislation cannot be retroactively applied to those cases. And I'd be happy to give a further analysis. I don't know how much the committee really wants to hear, but we do object to the retroactivity of this bill to those cases that have occurred since the Blakely decision.
Any members?
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure I understand that concern more fully. I mean, the Blakely dealt with the right to have facts that are going to cause a person to get incarcerated longer tried to a jury and found beyond reasonable doubt. And when this is a set of procedural steps in order to comply with that requirement. And so I guess I don't grasp the ex post facto issue here. If we're taking it, we're saying that as to people who have not yet been sentenced, and that's the retroactivity element of this, is that people who've been sentenced are not covered by this, if I'm reading it right. But people who have not been sentenced or whose case has been up at this maybe higher court level, maybe going back down for further sentencing, that they're subject to these rules. How does that violate the constitutional prohibition, which, if I understand it right, is that you can't pass a law saying that something that has already happened becomes criminal?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, the ex post facto analysis looks at what sentence the defendant could have received on the date of the crime. So if you go back to, and Blakely, I believe, was decided in 2004, September of 2004. and so if you look at someone who committed their offense in, say, December of 2004, after the Blakely decision, at that time, there was no way there was no procedure to give that person an upward departure sentence. The sentence that they could legally receive at that time was the presumptive sentence under the sentencing guidelines, because we had no law that provided a way to give them more than that presumptive sentence. So now we are creating a law that will enable them to give an increased sentence, and by applying that retroactively, you are giving that person a sentence that's greater than what they legally could have received at the time they committed their offense. So you're increasing the sentence. You're effectively increasing the sentence and applying it retroactively, and that is what the ex post facto clause that is part of what the ex post facto clause prohibits, is giving a person a greater sentence than they could have received on the date that they committed their offense. And a simpler way to look at that would be if a person committed a theft, and say I committed a theft today and it was a Class A misdemeanor and all I could get was a maximum of a year, but my case, the court didn't get to my case until the end of the session, and sometime during the session we passed a law to make that theft a Class A felony with a maximum penalty of 20 years. So that by the time I went to trial and was sentenced, I got 20 years instead of the 1 year that I could have gotten at the time that I committed the offense. That's a violation of ex post facto. I don't know if I made that any clearer.
If I could follow up, I think I'm following it, but wouldn't that be a problem? Any time there's a court decision then that says that you, procedural, and we haven't changed the penalties by legislation on what kind of sanctions will be applied to people for their misconduct, which is really the essence of what the ex post facto rule addresses. Anytime you have a court decision that prohibits or limits the ability to apply a certain sanction, you're saying that then a legislative response, because that court decision came down and the legislation is necessarily following on, in this case actually only, you know, within a year, which is pretty rocket time for the legislative process to respond to these issues, you'd have that problem.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, if I understand your question, you know, there are some cases that look at the ex post facto analysis deals with whether it's a substantive change versus a procedural change. Mm-hmm. And if that's what your question is.
Okay. And you're explaining it better than I had presented it. But it does seem to me we're dealing here with the procedure by which we can apply criminal sanctions, not by the magnitude of the penalty is. And so to say that because we have a procedural problem under a court decision that we can't apply the sanctions that the law already applied because we haven't gotten the procedure straightened out right, that isn't, I've had a little difficulty going there.
And Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, this comes straight from Jeff Fisher's mouth last weekend, and his opinion was that the more recent ex post facto cases coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court state that the analysis should not simply be whether it's substantive or procedural, but the analysis should be on the end result for the defendant. Did this defendant get a more harsh punishment than they could have at the time of the incident? And that is why, under that analysis, you can see that, yes, they did, because at the time that they committed their offense, Blakely had basically done away with upward departures because we didn't have a way to impose them. We didn't have a constitutional procedure to impose them. That being the case, there were no upward departures. And now we create a procedure. We basically are recreating upward departures, and we're applying that increased sentence. The end result for the defendant, assuming that they get an upward departure, is that they get a greater sentence than they could have received at the time that they committed their offense. So it's a more end result analysis than the substantive versus procedural. And I will say that Pete Gartland from the Public Defense Services office is here and may be able to give you a better, I'm really giving you a thumbnail sketch of this.
Okay, that's fine for now. Thanks.
Mr. O'Leary, would you comment, please?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I wanted to add one thing about the ex post facto argument Ms. Guy's making, that there is it's premised on the argument that under current law, the court has no authority to impose an upward departure by convening a sentencing jury. And that is a premise that has not yet been decided by an Oregon court. That exact issue was decided in the state of Washington in the case of State of Washington versus Hughes, the court in Washington determined, and under a similar scheme as Oregon's, that in light of Blakely, under the Washington state sentencing guidelines, which required the judge to make the determination about a departure sentence, that the judge had no authority to, without legislation, without a statute, to convene a sentencing jury to consider an enhanced sentence. And we don't have an Oregon case that says that yet, and I don't know if we will. But I just wanted to point out that the ex post facto argument, that is a necessary component of any successful ex post facto argument, and it's not present right now.
Did the Washington case raise an ex post facto challenge then? Was that the issue was in that case?
The Washington case was cases of enhanced sentences that were court decided after Blakely, and the Washington Supreme Court examined them and said these were unlawful under Blakely because there was no jury, and it went on to say that there is no statutory authority for the courts to convene a sentencing jury under then existing Washington law. I note that the Washington legislature has passed a similar bill to this measure, and that under Washington law it operates retroactively by function of existing case law.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions, concerns, comments? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Is there anyone who wanted to testify that hadn't signed up? Okay. We're going to recess for about 5 minutes. Please. So, and I believe everyone who has testified was signed up to testify and the audience has done so. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 528. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 528A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson has moved Senate Bill 528A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Excuse me? She's excused.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Work?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 528A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'd like to have Representative Olson and McPherson co-carry, please. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3476.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3476 be reported out without recommendation as to passage and the bill be referred to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs.
Judge, excuse me, we're going to go ahead and depart for the next bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate very much being allowed to appear by phone. Thank you very much and have a good day.
Thank you. Representative Olson has moved House Bill 3470 to be reported out without recommendation as to passage and the bill referred to the Committee on State and Federal Affairs. Any discussion on the motion? Those of the opinion that House Bill 3476 be reported out without recommendation as to passage and the bill referred to Committee on State and Federal Affairs say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. And we have finished our work for the day and we're adjourned. Thank you.